Hey, good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, depending upon where in the world you are and whether you're catching us during the day or you're catching us at night or if you're catching us after hours on a podcast. I am Eric Rubenstein. I am the Senior Director of Litigation, Fraud, Waste, and Abuse here at Advise Health. And this is part of our ongoing series of the OIG files. This week, I'm joined by my two co-workers here at Advise and longtime friends, former OIG special agents and supervisory special agents, Wade McFowl, who is on our SIU team, and Jason Eisengrein, who is our director in charge of special projects. And for those of you that know Jason and Wade, they have been in the space for a very long time. Wade served as a special agent in the Los Angeles field office and as an assistant special agent in charge, or ASAC, in the Los Angeles field office until his retirement about 5 years ago. He then went on and worked for a period of time for the MEDIC, which is the Medicare Part C and D benefit integrity contractor, and now has been with us for some time on our SIU team, provided subject matter expertise for our fraud, waste, and abuse clients. And everybody should know Jason. Jason Eisengrein was a special agent in the New York regional office with me, went on to be an assistant special agent in charge at the New York regional office, went on to headquarters where he had a number of senior leadership positions, and then retired and went on for about 13 or 14 years operating on a bunch of CMS contracts, most recently as the Western UPIC director. And Jason is now with us here. So good to see you guys as always. I'm always glad to catch up with my two dear friends and coworkers. It's great to know full circle that we've come to be able to be together again in our next iteration of life, or as Jason likes to call it, chapter three. So today we want to spend some time talking about a topic that is really a very hot topic to the LinkedIn community. We have a lot of people on LinkedIn that tune into our podcast and you know, kind of catch what we are talking about. And it really is the length of time, or seemingly the unreasonable length of time, that some healthcare fraud investigations seem to take. You know, when you go online and you read a lot of press releases, you see that an investigation was where the individual was prosecuted for something in the period of time 2013 to 2017 or 18, and it is now going on 2023, and the case is finally coming to a resolution. And I spend a lot of time on LinkedIn and podcasts and blogs and speaking to people about why it is that healthcare fraud investigations seem to take an inordinate amount of time. I think people rely a lot on law and order, where the person gets arrested, prosecuted, and adjudicated all within, you know, what appears to be a rather speedy amount of time, notwithstanding the Speedy Trial Act, which requires 100 days till a person gets prosecuted. And just a quick moment to mention that is that, you know, under the federal Speedy Trial Act, people are entitled to have a trial within 100 days. But there are a number of carve-outs and caveats, the least of which is that if a case is designated as a complex investigation or a complex matter, that the Speedy Trial Act does not count. So most healthcare cases get treated that way. And as such, the 100-day Speedy Trial Act doesn't really apply. So really what I want to do is I want to talk a little bit about, you know, at first from the investigative phase, and I'll turn this over to Wade as an agent. And then really when you were an assistant special agent in charge and having to kind of, you know, work within the investigations, tell me a little bit about, you know, as an agent and then working as an ASAC, what are some of the things that you saw that were pinch points, we'll call them, that created some of these time lags from a case being investigated, you know, through to prosecution?
Okay, sure. One of the things I'd point out, though, before I go into pinch points, is that, you know, if you think back to like when I started and Jason started and even when you started back in the early 90s, it was a completely different kind of game because, like, just for example, like ordering claims data, you didn't order it online and get it, you know, through the web, you know, a couple days later. It was you'd submit a claims data request and you'd get reams of paper, the track fed paper, you know, hundreds and hundreds of pages that you then have to go through with a highlighter and make notes. And so there wasn't all this, you know, fancy computing and the computing skills that all the agents have today. I know when I started, I didn't have any of those. I didn't know anything about Microsoft Access or Excel or any of those. So in that sense, even though today it seems like cases take a while, we're like light years ahead of where we were in the early 90s. So that's one thing to, I think, take into consideration.
And just to interrupt you real quick. I mean, you know, in today's world, an OIG agent, you know, somebody who's from the Office of Investigations, and we'll start calling it OI because that's what we always would call it. But someone who is with OI today can sit at their laptop, can go in through a database that is essentially a repository. It's known as the IDR. OIG uses something called 1PI, which is the data sort of warehousing system. And they can, you know, right at their desktop, they can go and request a report and get that report run overnight and kind of the next day. So yeah, you're right. Light years ahead from where things were, but there are a million other things, right? Getting a billing history, which used to take maybe a week or two or three and it would come on disk or whatever. So that's gone, but there's still a lot of other factors that are outside of control of an OI agent outside of getting that billing history.
Right. One of the things is, you know, we use a lot of different methods. Each investigation is different, but some investigations might include more of a historical aspect where you're subpoenaing records. And, you know, if you issue a subpoena, you have to give them, you know, 30 days, and they almost always ask for an extension. So you're waiting maybe 60 or 90 days before you even get the records, before you start reviewing them and analyzing them. Another couple things that can really be a time crunch is a lot of our investigations would involve consensual monitoring or undercover, a lot of different types of recordings, even Title III's. I've been involved with some where you have to, anything that's recorded, you have to not only make a transcript of it, a lot of times you have to do translations and transcripts. So if you have a 1 hour or a 2 hour meet, and there's no budget for transcription services, so now you as the agent have to sit there with a kind of shady, staticky recording and go over and try and get a transcript where you can account for everything that was said. And that can take, you know, that can take weeks. And that's for, you know, even one recording, a 2 or 3 right. hour recording could take forever. So that's another thing. I just want to interrupt it.
So two things. Well, so from the subpoena perspective, because that takes time. So what a lot of people don't realize is that there are a number of different subpoenas that the Office of Investigations has the ability to get for service. One is a grand jury subpoena, and the grand jury subpoenas are issued through the U.S. Attorney's Office. And so those typically are the ones that you can get the quickest, because you go to your local assistant U.S. attorney, you have someone that you're working with on the case, they issue the subpoena, you go and you get it served. But then some of the other ones, the HIPAA subpoena now is a common one that is similar to the grand jury subpoena in the way it gets issued. It comes from the U.S. Attorney's Office. But, you know, another subpoena that is a common one that's used in investigations and the like is the OIG subpoena. And that's the one that takes a fairly lengthy period of time to get, right? Because an agent puts together what they want in the subpoena. It then gets routed through ultimately to the Office of Counsel, to the Inspector General. They do a review. It then gets approved. It could take weeks to get that approved, or, you know, something like that. Then gets sent back. Then it has to be signed by the agent in charge of the region. So the, you know, getting subpoenas could be a lag. But let's talk for a little bit. I do want to talk about the consensual and you mentioned the term Title III, which is a wiretap. But, you know, when you're talking about the issuance of a subpoena, you get your subpoena. Then you got to go and you got to serve it. And that can take some time to do. And then let's expand a little bit more about that lag in time from when you issue the subpoena to actually turning over the records, right? So there's a due date, and no one ever wants to meet that due date because they always want more time. And, you know, particularly when we're talking about a subpoena to a provider, right? So let's talk a little bit, let's unpack that a little bit, because that actually can create huge time lags. From the day that you serve it to the receipt of the records, and it could be for financial, it could be to a provider, right? So, what, you know, let's talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, when an agent is considering, you know, issuing a subpoena for records, the first thing you want to do is make sure that you cast the net wide enough. You get everything that you want, because you don't want to have like a subset of the information you want, and you start reviewing it and you say, "Geez, I wish I would have asked for these other aspects of the bank records or the billing history or whatever it may be. So you cast the net wide, which means you're going to get a lot of records, you know, in return. And again, after probably two or three requests for extensions, but eventually you're going to get the records. And now it's just the start of the work for the agent. Now you have to comb through and try and, you know, determine what is evidentiary and what's not, and how you're going to use that. Pair that evidence with the law that you're trying to show that they broke with the statute. So then you have to just take all that information and kind of pair it with what the allegation is in your attempt to prove right. The allegation to support that claim.
And this takes a lot of time, right? So yeah. So now I want to turn over to Jason, because at one point Jason was responsible for a lot of things that involved what we would call consensual monitoring and Title III or wiretaps. So the big difference is consensual monitoring doesn't require a court order. Consensual monitoring is that you've got a cooperating witness who's wearing a covert recording device and making a recording, either audio, video, or a combination of the two. And whereas a wiretap or a Title III are for things in which the parties that are being monitored are not consenting. And Jason, when you were at headquarters, you ran a couple of different groups as an agent in charge that had a very heavy presence involved with consensual monitoring and wiretaps. So if I can just turn it over to you, that time lag that now kind of exists, and understanding that you're serving subpoenas maybe at the same time, you're waiting for records at the same time, you're maybe doing consensual monitoring. But let's talk for just a few minutes about that piece of the puzzle, because you had some pretty intrinsic involvement with those.
Well, I think Wade did an excellent job of capsulizing what causes those time lags. So it doesn't just end though with the available time that the agent has. As soon as it moves into an area that might require some expert review, and I'll talk a little bit about what I mean about an expert review in a second, but at that point, it rises to another whole level, right? So if they're talking about a medical procedure and a review by nurses or doctors, pharmacists, whatever clinical expert is relevant to that service, that just brings in another whole level of people, money for those people that are needed. And those types of things, it exponentially to the time factor. And then the next part of it are the parts of the process that are out of the agent's control. So if the subpoena is for documents, as Wade already said, there may be requests for extension, but at some point you may want to have subpoenas for testimony. And at that point, you'd start to evoke the grand jury process. It becomes a matter of, does the court have the time to do this? And during COVID, obviously the courts were closed at some occasions and things of that nature. So there are the outside factors and the inside factors. But just again, sticking with the inside factors and in control of OI is resources. And agents aren't assigned one investigation, except maybe in a very rare instance. They all have competing interests from having a wide variety of investigations. So it's finding the time to do it as well.
You know, so you bring up that, which is really caseload management. And I remember when I was a new agent and I was being mentored by a guy named Jason Eisengrind. At one point, I had a very high caseload, and I remember during a regional inspection from headquarters, somebody told me I had the highest caseload in the country, and I'd only been an agent for about a year, and they asked me, well, what are you going to do? You have all these cases, and I said, yeah, well, once all those prosecutions come in, I won't have as many cases. But caseload management is a really important factor. Now, Jason, you brought up something, and I want to have you put on your UPIC director's hat, which is the competing factors that the UPIC has to deal with. So one of the biggest things is that OI has to rely in some regards on the UPICs for the provision of information. And that information gets to the request for information comes out of something called an RFI. And the RFI goes to the UPIC. And it could be for something as simple as a provider application, or it could be for something like EFT information for direct deposit, things that the OIG doesn't have direct access to getting, or may have a limited access to getting, but needs, you know, that actual document. Now, you know, when you're in the UPIC West and you've got, you know, dozens of agents, but you're not just also filling requests for information from the OIG, meaning Office of Investigations. You could be getting requests for information from Office of Audit Services, Office of Evaluation and Inspection, other law enforcement entities, state entities, regulatory bodies. It's just it's an unbelievable amount of data that's coming in for requests to go out, and that has to go into a queue. So that has to increase that lag time as well, right?
Absolutely. So whether it's OI or the contractor, there's a budget. And, you know, this is a business operation. So a budget is created based on some expectation. But if the level of requests increases beyond the capacity of the budget, then it requires a conversation with the entity supplying that money. So in purposes of this conversation and a UPIC, that would be the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS. And so that starts a process that could take months or even a year for a reevaluation of the budget related to that. So whenever, as a control point, when an entity makes a request for information and the contractor evaluates that it may take more than 40 hours, it then needs to be submitted to CMS for consideration. If this is within the scope of the operation, if it's within the budget, and if it's the, you know, offering the best value to the government. So those factors, it always boils down to, if you just think about this as a business operation, it's what are the resources, what is the availability of the supply chain? The supply chain in these cases is going to be information, whether it be in the form of documents or witnesses, and then the ability of the outside players to manage those vulnerabilities.
So, and you know, you, me, and Matt, just the other day, we actually had a whole conversation about the OE&I study on the UPICs, and that was a little bit of that conversation, was the budget constraints on being able to do things. So, Wade, I want to go back to you, because now I want you to put on your ASAC hat, and now you got the issue of the prosecution, right? And so, you know, prosecutions can take a really long time. And, you know, some of that is what's known as the discovery process in a criminal case. Or in a civil case, there's discovery. In a civil case, there's deposition notices, interrogatories, all of that stuff. But ultimately, it's the turning over of documents and evidence and the review and sort of what's the pitch to the defendant. Do they want to take this case to trial, or do they want to try to resolve it? And I know you were an intrinsic part at the LA field office as an ASAC in dealing with, you know, the U.S. attorney's offices and, you know, liaisoning with them. What did you see as some of the pinch points that came at the U.S. Attorney's Office that also created this kind of lag in time that made this less of a law and order case than a real life?
Yeah, and it's definitely, you know, the agents would meet with the Assistant United States Attorney on an ongoing basis. I'd have them meet early to make sure that they're on the same page on, you know, first of all, are they accepting the case? Second of all, what's kind of the process? What are they looking for? What are they going to charge? And what do they need in as far as evidence to charge those charges? So one other thing is the Central District of California had they were kind of known for really being sticklers on, we used to talk about calling it pulling the trigger. They wouldn't pull the trigger on a case because that starts a timeline that you have to abide by. But the agents had to basically have the cases not necessarily trial ready as like we can go to trial tomorrow, there'd still be some logistical things to do, photocopy and things of that nature. But as far as all the issues being met with, you know, evidence to prove them, those cases had to be really trial ready before even considering going in front of a grand jury to, you know, form an affidavit and get ready to charge. So there was a lot of talk about like dotting I's and crossing T's. The affidavits, which maybe would be several hundred pages long, had to be perfect, and they had to address every issue that was in question in the case, and they had to have evidence to back it up, and that evidence had to be correctly logged. And there's so many processes in place that even when the agents thought that they were, you know, pretty close to being ready, we would meet with the U.S. Attorney's office and they would get a list of things to do that a lot of times agents weren't expecting. And it depended on which prosecutor it was. Some of them really wanted everything, and the agents were like, you know, you don't want to work with this guy because he's asking for the moon. But that's what had to be done before you could start that process that started the timeline.
Yeah, you know, oftentimes, you know, we would use the term moving the ball, right? It's like the U.S. Attorney's Office would come to you and they would say, all right, in order to charge this provider, criminally, civilly, whichever it would be, they would say, you know, I need these things. Like, we need to be able to prove these things. And then you'd go and you'd prove them, or you'd bring in evidence to show indicia. You know, I like to use the terms indicia of fraud, because ultimately, right, it's the jury or the U.S. Attorney's Office that's charging that says this is fraud. But they would go back and they would say, in order for us to really charge, we need to have some evidence of X, Y, Z. And then you'd go out and you'd get it. And they would go, no, 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 we need this. And then, you know, and I remember in one case in particular where that just kept happening. You know, they would say, all right, we got to do this. And it's like, okay, we get this. And so you got to do this and you get this. You know, one case in particular I remember was a kickback case where the U.S. Attorney's Office wanted two recordings with the cooperator who was paying cash kickbacks. They wanted two good recordings for each individual that was taking the cash. And so, you know, we go out, we get the two recordings. It takes us 2 months to do that because each kickback payment is paid once a month. And we go back, we say, hey, we got these 20 recordings. And, you know, they review them. They go, well, this one is not as good. So now we need you to go get a third recording. And then you're going back and you're getting a third one. And, you know, when you look from the first to the second to the third, you're, you know, it's like nothing substantially changes. It's like, you know, you don't really get that sense. But, you know, that's a, you know, that you're going from 1 month to 2 months to 3 months. Then you've got to deal with getting all the financial documents after it ends. You know, bank records. I think what people don't realize is that bank records can take months to get. Credit card records can take months to get. And then for the most part, even when you get those records electronically, you still need to ingest them. You need to review them. You know, I do a lot of presentations on OIG sort of investigative operations. And what I always say is interviews will always lead to more interviews. Document reviews and subpoenas will always lead to more document reviews and more subpoenas. Consensual monitorings will always lead to more. So, you know, the challenge is that there, you know, it's kind of this perpetual thing. It never really ends. And I think that, you know, all of these things together are what create these kind of, we'll call them gaps. Things are always moving, but they're, you know, sometimes moving at a little bit of a snail's pace. So, you know, we're getting close to our time. Wade, I want to turn it over to you for some final thoughts and just some general opinions about, you know, where do you see efficiencies can be brought in as these investigations move forward? Where do you see things moving?
Well, as Jason was talking about it, a lot of it, if not all of it, boils down to like resources. And I know with OI, we used to hear a lot of, you have to do more with less. That was like the buzzwords. And we, you know, you can try and do that for a while. And then after a while, it's like, you can't, you can only do this, you know, the same with the same. You can't do more with less. So it really is a budgeting issue a lot of times. And like, again, it's like caseload is a big thing too. We talk about moving these things along, and I think Eric, you talked about it too, but not only do they have to make all these steps in each case, but this might be one of 15 or 18 cases that have to be, that all need attention. You can't just back burner 19 cases and work on one of them. So even when the documents are coming in, they may have to sit for a couple of weeks before you get a chance to look at them. So when people get frustrated with how long it takes, they really have to consider the not only the resources, but the caseloads, I think, is the really big thing.
And Jason, to put on your UPIC hat, sort of as a closing thought, like, you know, how does the UPIC really manage the, I'll call it the shifting priorities, but it's really the deluge of information that the UPICs have to disseminate out on top of their normal required projects, and then on top of the special projects that are there?
Well, there are a lot of factors that influence those competing interests, as we talked about before. Ultimately, it boils down to what is the priority of the day. Certainly at the top of the list would be if there is any patient harm, that would be number one consideration. Some other considerations, though, are also related to the availability of that type of provider service in an area where you have a situation where it is a provider providing a unique service in most likely a rural area. There might have to be some delays factored in to maintain the stream of care to the patient. So those are the things at the top of the food chain in terms of competing priorities. But I do want to turn back to 1 minute regarding about OI and its budgeting. I would imagine that behind the scenes, OI is working diligently to get additional resources. I am sure that they're not just hoping for it, because I like to say that hope is not a plan. It's certainly, you know, it's great to be hopeful, but that's not the strategy I would want to follow to get those additional resources. But ultimately, what has been very successful for over 30 or 40 years with OI is to point out that their return on investment to the taxpayer is probably in the neighborhood of about $20 to every dollar of funding. So there is a positive return in expending those resources, because there is no doubt about it that healthcare and the budget of HHS remains the top budget in the world, frankly. It's greater than the Defense Department. It's really the third largest budget in the whole world. Take the U.S. budget as a whole, the Russian budget, and then below that is HHS. So it's extremely important and valuable to address the program integrity vulnerabilities.
Yes, this is great, guys. So we're just about out of time. You know, we're going to keep doing these conversations. We're going to keep bringing topics to the front. And, you know, bring Matt back into the fold on these, and we're just going to keep the conversation going. So thanks everybody for tuning in to our podcast from the OIG Files. Again, I'm Eric Rubenstein, the Senior Director of Litigation, Fraud, Waste, and Abuse, joined with Wade McFowl and Jason Eisenrein. Any information that we can share with you, we're happy to. Feel free to reach out to us at hello@advizehealth.com. We'll see you guys next time. Take care. Thank you.